Okay, so today we're diving straight into a really massive global moment, a real inflection point.
Yeah, one that came right after two, incredibly tough years of conflict.
Exactly. And what we're doing here, for you listening, is synthesizing the sources around the 2025 Gaza Peace Summit, this
Yeah.
huge event that happened like immediately after the Israel-Hamas war finally reached a reported ceasefire, October 2025.
Right. And this is a deep dive into some very high-stakes diplomacy. The location was Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. And the goal, well, the stated goal was enormous: peace and regional prosperity. But, the documents we've looked at, they strongly suggest the real action wasn't maybe on the main stage.
Fight the hidden stuff.
We're talking about some intense, pretty unreported backdoor diplomacy. That seems to be what really shaped the whole agreement.
The narrative they wanted out there was definitely clear, though. We've got that quote from Egyptian President el-Sisi.
Yeah, saying the summit aimed to end the war in Gaza and usher in a new page of peace and regional stability. I mean, that sounds incredibly ambitious, like a total reset for the Middle East.
It does. But what's really interesting right off the bat is the skepticism you find in the source material itself.
Absolutely. After 2 years of fighting, countless ceasefires that just, well, fell apart, everyone's asking, is this one actually different?
Understandably so.
But the feeling, the consensus that seems to emerge from the sources, is that the sheer scale of this thing, it signaled something was different, a potential turning point for peace and security in the region. Suggests the groundwork might have been more solid this time, even if we didn't see it laid.
Okay, so let's unpack that turning point. Section one in our material gets into the specifics, the immediate context of the summit itself. Where do we start?
Well, the date itself is interesting. Monday, October 13th, 2025. And the sources we analyzed, they consistently flag the timing.
How so?
They point out it coincided with Hoshana Rabbah. Now, for anyone unfamiliar, that's the seventh day of the Feast of Sukkot.
Okay. And traditionally, in Jewish thought, it's often seen as the day when the final judgment for the year ahead is, like, sealed. So the sources find it pretty significant that this major peace framework was finalized, or at least publicly presented, on that specific day.
Wow, okay. That adds a whole different dimension right away, doesn't it? It's sort of a prophetic framing from these sources.
It does. But sticking to the politics for a second, who was actually running the show? Who was at the main table?
Right, the key players.
It was co-chaired by the U.S. President Donald Trump and Egypt's President el-Sisi. And crucially, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was there too.
Okay, Trump, Sisi, Abbas, but hang on. The elephant not in the room.
Exactly. A huge critical absence. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he did not attend.
That seems massive. I mean, if Israel's leader isn't there for the big peace summit after a war involving Israel, how does that work? How credible is it?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
Does the source material imply the deal was basically done before the summit, like behind closed doors? That's precisely the implication, yes. The sources kind of suggest the summit was more about ratification, a public display of global unity and force, rather than the place for the really tough negotiations.
So, a signing ceremony more than a negotiation.
Sort of. The deal needed to be pre-cooked, especially given the scope here. These weren't just ceasefire goals. They were really comprehensive and built on the Abraham Accords framework already in place.
Okay, so let's talk about those comprehensive goals. What were they aiming for beyond just stopping the fighting?
The focus was really on three big areas, all linked. First, obviously, the immediate Israeli-Palestinian conflict, trying to find a resolution path there.
Makes sense.
Second, wider regional security, basically stopping the conflict from spreading, containing it. And third, international stability. Thinking about the knock-on effects, global energy markets, migration patterns, especially towards Europe, those were key concerns.
Right, the global ripple effects.
Yeah.
And drilling down into the diplomacy itself, what were the specific targets they hoped to hit with this big public event?
Okay, three main diplomatic objectives stand out. Objective A, just getting dialogue going again, opening the door for renewed peace talks, laying some groundwork.
Okay, dialogue first.
Objective B was about strengthening regional cooperation, really pushing neighboring Arab states to step up, play an active role in stability, moving them from just commentary to, actual involvement.
So getting them invested in the outcome,
Yeah.
not just observers.
Exactly. And then there's the devastation in Gaza itself. What about that?
Yeah, the humanitarian side must have been huge.
That was Objective C, getting serious international backing for sustainable aid and reconstruction in Gaza. Not just writing checks, but making sure help actually gets through without political roadblock.
And dealing with spoilers.
Crucially, yes. Objective C also specifically aimed at tackling the influence of non-state actors and foreign powers. Iran and its proxies were explicitly named as destabilizing forces that the regional partners needed to push back against together.
Wow. Okay, the sheer size of that security challenge, plus the reconstruction, you can see why they needed such a massive gathering. Which leads us right into section 2 of our source material. The title alone is dramatic. Covenant with many.
Yeah, that phrase really captures the scale. The attendance list itself was unprecedented.
Yeah.
It basically confirmed this wasn't just a regional issue anymore. It was a global coordinated effort. The word showed up.
Let's give people a sense of that diversity. Who was actually there? This wasn't just the usual suspects, right?
Not at all. You had the key Middle Eastern players, of course. Jordan's King Abdullah II, Qatar's Emir Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, Turkey's President Erdogan. Even getting some rival powers in the same room was significant.
Mm-hmm.
But it went way beyond that. Major Asian powers were represented. India sent its Minister of State for External Affairs. You had Indonesia's President Prabowo Subianto, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif.
And the West, ensuring accountability, presumably.
Absolutely. You saw leaders like the UK's Prime Minister Keir Starmer, France's President Macron, Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney, plus the big international bodies. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was there, the Arab League, the European Council.
Okay, that is a covenant with the many, a truly global lineup.
And with that kind of turnout, you'd expect big results.
Yeah.
They were aiming for tangible outcomes.
Such as?
Well, establishing a comprehensive peace framework was the headline goal. Also, getting a renewed solid commitment to support a two-state solution and practically creating a multilateral task force to actually oversee the humanitarian aid delivery.
So structures, not just statements.
Right. And the whole thing wrapped up with a big declaration and signing ceremony. The message was clear. Diplomacy over war.
Okay, that sounds incredibly impressive on paper. Global consensus, concrete steps. But this is where our deep dive takes that turn, doesn't it? Into the source's main argument, section 3. The back channel operator who allegedly made this covenant with the many actually happen.
Exactly. You just don't get that kind of global agreement, that level of coordination, unless someone's been doing some serious patient work behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And this is where the name Jared Kushner really comes into focus in the documents we reviewed.
Okay.
The claim is, basically, while he wasn't maybe front and center on stage, he played the central role, the back office role, in actually putting together the peace framework that was presented at the summit.
So what was his job leading up to it? It sounds like more than just advising.
The sources describe it as a specific mandate. He was sent to Israel beforehand, met with President Herzog in Jerusalem. The goal was hammering out the basic structure for the agreement.
And what were the key points he focused on?
Two absolute non-negotiables for Israel, according to the sources. Getting the hostages back and figuring out the exact mechanism to end the war with Hamas. He was basically sent in as the fixer.
Now, he's got history in this arena, doesn't he? We should remind ourselves he was central to the 2020 Peace to Prosperity Plan during the first Trump administration.
Right. He's not new to this. His experience is considerable, and so, apparently, is his network. His method is described as back-channel diplomacy, leveraging his personal relationships, especially with really key GARF leaders. We're talking about figures like Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, in Saudi Arabia, and Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ, in the UAE. Very powerful figures.
That's high-level networking, all right. So what's the common ground? What did Kushner tap into with these wealthy Arab states that made the Abraham Accords work and maybe made this 2025 framework possible where so many others failed?
The sources are pretty direct about it. They basically say money.
Money.
Yeah. They argue Kushner understood how to leverage these complex relationships by finding common ground based on finance and investment opportunities with these Arab leaders. That's why the Abraham Accords, focusing on normalization and economic ties, were successful. And that model became the template for this wider regional integration push in 2025.
But his involvement always comes with baggage, doesn't it? The source material points to significant criticism.
Oh, definitely. It notes that his previous plans were often seen as heavily favoring Israel, which led some commentators to give him that controversial label, Israel's favored son.
Being called that in the Arab world, that's a heavy label. How does someone overcome that perception to broker these massive deals?
Well, according to the material, the answer again circles back to economics. He's presented not just as a political dealmaker, but as someone designing economic development for the whole region.
And that economic angle takes us straight into Section 4, which deals with those persistent concerns about, well, financial entanglements. The argument from critics that Kushner's political work directly led to some very lucrative private business deals for him later on.
The sources certainly draw a direct line there. They highlight these private ventures, big real estate deals, other business interests, and point out they involve the same wealthy Arab states like Saudi Arabia and the UAE that he negotiated these major political deals with while in government.
Wait a minute. That raises huge questions, doesn't it, about transparency, potential conflicts of interest?
It absolutely does. It's a major red flag for critics cited in the sources. If the same people signing peace deals are also your private business partners, well, it reframes that whole regional prosperity narrative, doesn't it?
It really does. And that cynicism, it gets even deeper when you look at the money pouring into Gaza for reconstruction.
Yeah, there's one piece of analysis we looked at that makes a really stark, devastating argument. It basically says, global elites own the same corporations that make the bombs that have leveled Gaza and then own the same corporations that will rebuild it.
Wow. That is incredibly cynical, the idea that the same global players profit from the destruction and the rebuilding.
Exactly. It paints a picture where humanitarian aid and peace frameworks almost become just the next phase in a profit cycle.
Suggesting the whole thing, war, peace, rebuilding, is a kind of self-perpetuating business model for some.
That's the grim suggestion, yes. That the economic incentives are locked in almost regardless of whether there's peace or conflict.
So, putting aside his personal intentions, the sources seem to argue that Kushner's deep political connections and this financial normalization framework he helped build, they undeniably created the structure, the foundation, for whatever happens next in the region.
Right. He essentially designed the operating system, the sources suggest, for how this peace framework functions, built on economic development and those back-channel relationships.
Which explains why the summit itself, even without Netanyahu, could pull in such a massive global crowd. The important parts were maybe already locked in through these less visible, sometimes commercial, ties.
That seems to be the core argument emerging from this material. The structure was key.
Okay, so pulling this all together for you listening, we've looked at the hard facts of the summit, the stated goals, and then this alleged backdoor maneuvering, the financial threads. How should we ultimately view the success or potential success of this huge 2025 summit?
Well, based on everything we've reviewed, its actual success seems to hinge entirely on two things. First, genuine willingness from both Israeli and Palestinian leaders to actually compromise on the really tough final status issues. That's always the sticking point.
And second,
sustained commitment from the international community. Not just showing up for the photo op, but actually supporting the compromises and holding everyone accountable of political leaders and, crucially, those powerful financial stakeholders to make sure the agreement is upheld. Accountability is key.
And as we finish up this deep dive, the sources leave us with one last really provocative thought. It loops back to that biblical framing we mentioned earlier, connecting the political maneuvering to something else.
They do. It's quite a leap. But given Kushner's central role in building this economic normalization, this regional peace structure, the material poses a pretty challenging question.
Which is?
They ask whether Kushner's work setting up this unified economic and security architecture might actually be paving the way for some future world leader. Yeah. And they take it further, asking if he's perhaps acted, maybe unintentionally, maybe not, as a kind of modern John the Baptist figure. Preparing the path through all this economic development and normalization via back channels for the rise of the biblical Antichrist.
Okay, that is definitely a provocative thought to end on. It forces you to look at these complex political and financial dealings through a completely different, almost unsettling lens.
It certainly does. A lot to think about there.